Hope you're getting some rest. Yes? Okay. Go like this too. Sort of. Thank you. Yeah, it's good to get rest on retreat. And I just have to share that when I was walking in to the hall just now, a chipmunk scurried into the ecstatic array of coleus that's right outside the door there. You know, that stack. Is that those coleus? Coleus, I think. And he jumped into one of the pots. He's digging one of the pots, and soil went spraying. So it's like wrecking havoc there. It's pretty cool, pretty cute. It's hard to keep the wild out. So this morning for our Dharma study, we're going to move from Japan into the realm of Tibet and Tibetan literary culture to sample some wilderness love and ecstasy from that culture. And we're going to look this morning at this song, the spontaneous song of experience from Jigme Lingpa, and I forgot somehow in pulling it off the computer to include who the author was and also the place, which we do know he wrote at Sami Chimpu because he says so in his memoir, Appearances Unleashed. So this is an extract from his memoir that I'm working on right now. I'm working on translating it from the Tibetan into the English. And that partly inspired this retreat, I mean, the topic of this retreat and the direction of this retreat towards ecstatic song, because I've been working on this memoir, and the memoir is full of songs. He gives a little bit of context, and he does, you know, there's some prose, he sets up the situation, and then he offers a song, he offers poetry. So I've found working with that poetry to be very powerful, and that was why I brought so much of it into this retreat, because I found it very powerful for my own practice, and then wanted to share that with you, that kind of accessing the power of poetry and the power of the written word to evoke the Dharma through the natural world. And so Jigme Lingpa, a little bit about him, he was a practitioner of this same tradition from which the treasure teachings arise. And in fact, he was a treasure finder. He was one of these treasure finders, Jigme Lingpa. He was a Tertön. And he found Terma in the earth. He found Terma in the water. He found mind Terma and space Terma. These are the different kinds of treasures, right? He found these different kinds of treasures, Jigme Lingpa. And in some ways, this text is a treasure because this text, not very well known in Tibet, was hidden. The text that came into my hands that I'm working from was hidden in around 1958-1959 during the Cultural Revolution. So I don't know how much you know about the history of China and Tibet, but there was a very rough period in the late 50s when China invaded Tibet and bombed the monasteries and ransacked the libraries and burned the books, you know, huge book burnings, like just bonfires of book burnings, because religion, according to Mao, was the opiate of the masses and needed to be flattened and destroyed. They moderated their perspective later, or they moderated how they deal with religion now, but back then, in the 50s, in the Maoist era, it was about you just need to get rid of it. You need to get rid of it. So they were doing that and imprisoning the high teachers and torturing people. I mean, it was very, very traumatic. It was like the Holocaust of Tibet. And it was as bad as the Holocaust. So it's interesting that, you know, we don't hear that much about it. It's not like people are talking about it, or we don't know. I mean, most people don't even know it happened. But it was as bad. And I think part of the reason they don't know is the language barrier. How many people know Tibetan, right? And even now, how many Tibetans know English? So I actually heard many of the stories, like the first-person accounts of that period, from many of my friends who are Tibetan, telling me what their experience was like. So I know, actually, exactly what they went through. And it was very Holocaustian, loss of whole families, torture, murder, mass murder, genocide, and imprisonment. So anyway, it was a rough period. So in that period, to preserve the books, which were so precious to the Tibetan people, just like our books are precious to us, our literature is precious to us, they hid stashes of books around their landscape. So when we talk about treasure teachings, they literally buried libraries under the ground in order to keep them from destruction. They hid them in caves and then walled up the caves. They did things like that. And even now, people are discovering those caches. Sometimes they discover them because somebody who hid them has come back to the Tibetan region and said, I want to try to find this. They've, you know, fled and they're in India or something, but they come back and they say, it's over here somewhere, and then they dig it up and find it. So that was true with this text. So this was a hidden treasure, quite literally, in the 50s, and now it has been unearthed. So we get to enjoy it, and thanks to somebody's bravery, someone's courage, somewhere. Okay, so a little about Jigme Lingpa. So he was one of those types, kind of like Ryokan, who started out getting some kind of formal education. He at least learned. He never became a monk, but he learned how to write and read from his close relative, his uncle, who taught him how to write and to read. And he did develop some relationship with his local monastery, and so got some Dharma training from that local monastery, and ended up doing a 3-year retreat at Samye, which is in central Tibet. And then after that 3-year retreat, and that's where his memoir takes up, this comes from, he became disillusioned with his life in the town, in the monastery, just disillusioned. He doesn't say exactly what he's disillusioned with, like he doesn't talk specifics, but he says, I became disillusioned. I became weary of life in the monastery, life in the village, and I decided, he says, to wander in the wide, wild world and to explore the ancestral lands of my lineage. And so he takes off on his own he has two friends, so not totally on his own. He takes off with his two friends and he starts across the landscape, and he decides he's going to go back to Samye, where he did his 3-year retreat, and he's going to go beyond Samye into the mountains behind Samye, where there's this cave complex, this complex of caves. Has anyone been to the Himalayan region? Anyone? Okay, yeah, some, all right, good. So yeah, there's lots of caves there. And this particular mountain is full of caves with rock overhangs and places where yogis can meditate. So he went back to this mountain where all these caves are, and he just starts wandering. He ends up in a cave, and he starts wandering from cave to cave. And very early on when he gets there, he finds this particular cave that he says is so comfortable, and so the view is so spectacular that he decides he's going to set up shop there and spend some nights there in the cave. And while he's sitting in the mouth of the cave on his first morning after waking up from his night there, he sings this song. So this is the setup for where he is. And he's sitting at the mouth of his cave, and he's gazing down at the valley below. And this is what comes to him. So when reading it, there are, when we're reading Asian texts, there is vocabulary that we're like, what? And, as you noticed over the last 2 days, you get to a word and you've never spoken that word before. You don't know how to pronounce it. So as we read, no problem. Just try. It's not a problem. It's not a problem that you can't pronounce. And in fact, that's what makes exploring these texts kind of exciting, because there's so much we don't know. And it's such a different world. And it's like the beginning of this entry into a different world, different language, different terms, different place names, different names of people that we've never heard. And so there's something very fresh about it. But it also involves some stumbling. So if you're self-conscious about that, don't worry about it at all. You just try to sound it out. That's what I did too when I was first exposed to these texts. You just try. And eventually, and I'll help, I can help you. Eventually you'll get it. So some things that I wanted to just pull out before we read it is just in the beginning, Father Lotusborn is a name. It's the name of Padmasambhava, who is the Indian master who brought Dharma from India to Tibet. So the story goes. But actually, Dharma was probably filtering over the border in many ways, but he's credited with having brought it. And Queen Dakini is his partner, Yeshe Tsojal. Dakini is this term that means literally, it means sky dancer. Sky dancer. Dakini, the one who goes in the sky. And it's a word that means the sacred feminine practitioner, something like that. Sacred feminine practitioner, Dakini. And then just going down a little bit, where it says glorious minister of Chimpu. So Chimpu is a place name. It's the place name of that cave complex. And below that, Indra Maritsye. Okay, Indra Maritsye, which is also a name. I think most of the place names are pretty clear because they're capitalized. Yeah, so if you don't know what a word is, it's probably a place name. And then on the page 2, I just wanted to mention one more word that I want to define. And there may be others that I'm missing, but this one did pop out at me at the top of the second page. In the top paragraph, a few times he uses the word Vajra. Vajra. And Vajra is difficult to define, actually, but I'm going to say adamantine, which means diamond-like, something like diamond-like. Okay, I'm just going to use that as a definition, but those of you who are practitioners of this tradition are like, oh, so many different definitions of that word, but let's say diamond-like, just so that you have something in mind when you're reading it. You can say Vajra, but at least you have something in your mind as you read it. All right. So let's begin going around reading together. And I would say, because there's not any particular gaps or paragraphs, to read four lines, and then you can pass it to the next person. And when we get to appearances as metaphor, you know, read until the end of that song. And then with appearances as metaphor, after ho-ho, we're going to again begin four lines each, just so you can get a sense. So we do begin again with the four lines each there. Okay, I think that'll be good enough. Does anyone want to volunteer to start? Oh. Yeah, you want to start? Oh, please. Lisa.
Father Lotus Born, Essence of Bliss Transcendent, Queen Dakini, Lady of the Citadel, Ocean of Saviors, Disciples Who Tend Awareness, the child deep within my heart misses you.
In this 7th month of the Iron Male Dragon Year, the glorious minister of Chimpu stirs in the throat of the impious vagabond Indra Maritsi, here in this native consciousness.
Oh, maybe. So, yeah, I just realized, if there's a period, yeah, stop at the period, because I just realized you started a sentence. You did. You can start with here in this native consciousness. Yeah.
Here in this native consciousness, beyond the unfolding drama of the mind's six senses, these high snow mountains, pillars of the sky, rise.
Sides ringed with slate and clay, weathered with crimson vultures soaring, their base a home for pheasants brooding, while marmots frolic in pika's burrow.
These virgin slopes, untouched by human travel, welcome bees busy in their quest for nectar. At the apex of this wondrous place, I dwell within. A pale turbinacle, spontaneous natural cave, tortoiseshell, stone shape.
A canopy of dark southern clouds erupts above, a diadem of mist hovers below, percussed with the haunting caw of crows, amidst the spontaneous swirling rainbow colors of Togol, light spheres and delicate threads dance, and the timed three bodies realized, while atop the crystal cave of sacred Yarlung, this place ruled by the fire god, rainbow pavilions of the five colors arc across the sky.
I think, surely I've arrived at Udayana, these colors piercing my water bubble eyes. Bestow radical simplicity, aimless awareness wanders there where it will, while natural resting overflows abundantly. Punctured by experiences of infinite bliss, yet free from the caprice of sorrow and joy.
When my Vajra brother said, I need 3 spontaneous homilies in the lineage of Vajra songs, the fresh radiance of these reflections gently unfurled, and I sang this song of appearances as metaphor.
Appearances as metaphor. Ho ho! Deep in the vast expanse of insubstantial sky above, crimson vultures bank their wings with confidence, showing off. So too I soar, aimless and free from distraction in this sky of naturally free expanse of appearances in mind.
Below, in verdant gardens with their fecund earth, the leaves of aromatic shrubs and forests dance. So too I, in order to proliferate experiences, train the energy of awareness within the sway of thought.
In between, in the villages of humans of desire realm, ravishing goddesses flaunt their clothes and jewelry. So too I, in the state of limitless vast expanse, wear as ornaments these impressive impressions of appealing outer objects.
To the melody of the swirling waves of Kokonor, dancers clasp the waist of their elegant spouses. So I too, in order to mix mind with appearances, reside in the ocean of free resting, but am decisive.
In the courtyards of these great monasteries, geshas engage in endless debate with refutation and proofs. So I too rest in nature, in a state free from the 8 extremes of conceptual elaboration, but forge a path of awareness within the afterglow of samsara and nirvana.
On their thrones, dressed in silks, with cushions piled high, great lamas display all kinds of activity. So too I, in order to adopt the path of interdependence, sustain the view and meditation that discerns mind from awareness.
Outside, a pleasant beauty arranged estate. Beautifully arranged estate. The proprietor cuts bed ropes for the servants. So too I, in a self-arranged cave, strongly subdue proliferating objects.
In the snare of many beloved households, matrons exert themselves in agriculture. So too I, in the field of authentic behavior, cultivate the intention of the innate freedom of the paths and levels.
On the turquoise mandala of the highlands, herders tend their cattle and sheep. So too I corral these lamb herds of thought within the enclosure of non-conceptual insight.
On this country's narrow paths and solitary places, numerous bandits try to rob poor people. So too, I let the practice of pursuing the face of appearances plunder the 8 worldly preoccupations.
In these spacious, indeterminate lands, realized yogins hack at the jaws of watchdogs. So I too, at the portal to the vast expanse of enlightenment, send the dog owner of dualistic clinging
on the run.
On the threshold of preposterous households, beloved children play with objects. So I too, in the hamlet of uncontrived naturalness, enjoy the amusements of subjective wakeful awareness.
In samsara, various entertainments appear. In nirvana, there is freedom from good and bad, acceptance and rejection. The entire mind has one basis, but 100 moods. It plainly arises as the mirror of ignorance and awareness.
Leaping into the clear light, continued. Those appearances are bound in examples. Those very examples are joined with meanings. If those very meanings are commented on with words, it may irritate the mind of your average person. But if you take it to heart, this is true speech. If those with knowledge analyze it, they will understand.
I, this child of good lineage, cut the subtle threads of hope and fear. When uplifted and inspired, I take them into a song of life. I wandered to this unpopulated place, an isolated mountain cave.
My mind free within, I plant the banner of practice, pursuing the doctrine of primordially pure exhaustion of phenomena. First, this awe-inspiring chatter. Second, this is straight talk.
Third, these are words of the naturally arising enlightened intention. On top of this mountain that seems to ridicule the sky, by the light rays of the great expanse of wisdom and love, I behave like a demoness indeed.
Okay, so let's try words that pique your interest, that resonate. Oh, no need to raise hands.
So too.
Yeah, just speak them out. Go ahead.
I actually have a question.
Mm-hmm.
It's about language.
About what?
About language.
Okay.
I've seen nirvana spelled with a B.
Oh, okay. Let's hold on to that question. Let's hold on to that question. Questions, let's hold on. Yes, but just speaking out. But do bring that up again if I forget to address it.
The entire mind has one basis, but 100 movements.
At the apex of this wondrous place, that's where I want it. At the apex of this wondrous place.
The child deep within my heart misses you. Primordially pure exhaustion.
Uddiyana.
Aimless awareness wanders where it will.
In samsara, various entertainments appear.
While natural resting overflows abundantly.
So too I, in order to adopt the path of interdependence, sustain a view of meditation that discerns mindful awareness.
Children play, amusements await for awareness.
Punctuated by experiences of infinite bliss.
Pursuing the doctrine of primordially pure exhaustion of phenomena. Sides rimmed with slate and clay, wreathed with crimson vulture soaring. Sends the dog owner a dualistic clinging on the woman. These colors piercing my water bubble eyes.
Queen Dakini, lady of the citadel. Mm.
These are words of the naturally arising enlightened perception.
When I have free within, I plant the banner of practice, pursuing the doctrine of primordial pure exhaustion of phenomena.
Percussed with the haunting call of crows. By the light rays of the great expanse of wisdom and love, I behave like a demoness, indeed.
So too are Karelli's landmarks of thought within the enclosure of the non-conceptual insight.
When uplifted and inspired, I take them into a song of life.
These virgin slopes untouched by human travel, punctuated by experiences of infinite bliss. The entire mind has one basis, but 100 moods. It plainly arises as the mirror of ignorance and awareness.
Realize Yogin's hack, the jaws of watchdogs.
I, this child of good lineage, cut the subtle threads of hope and fear.
Those appearances are bound in examples. Those very examples are joined with meanings.
Welcome bees busy in their quest for nectar. I plant the banner of practice.
Surely I've arrived in Uddiyana.
Spontaneous natural cave, tortoise shell, stone shape.
I, this child of good lineage, cut the subtle threads of hope and fear.
Deep and vast expanse of insubstantial sky above, crimson vultures bank their wings with confidence showing off.
So do I soar aimlessly free from distractions of naturally free states of appearances of mind.
These colors piercing my water bubble eyes. First, this is awe-inspiring chatter. Second, this is straight talk. Third, these are words with a naturally arising, enlightened intention.
So now some feeling words, some feelings that come. Could be the feeling that you feel from the author, or it could be the feeling that comes from you connecting to the material. Either.
I feel safety, spontaneous, natural cave, tortoise shell, stone shape.
Okay, we'll try to keep it to 1 to 2 words, feeling words, but thank you. Yes, no judgment on that. That was great. Just the feelings.
Very humorous.
Playfulness. Tickled.
Expansive.
Free within.
Inspiration.
Joy and sorrow. Affirmation.
Exploration.
Passion.
Clarity.
Distracted. Powerful.
Childlike. Illusion. Non-judgmental.
Teasing.
Connection.
Complimentary.
All right. So let's move into questions and the parts where you were drawn, that we just spoke aloud, just exploring more deeply why that, what drew you to that, and what do we think it means? Or what it, how does it land on you? And so one of the questions that came up was about this word nirvana versus nibbana. So those are two different languages. Nibbana is Pali, and nirvana is Sanskrit. And because the Tibetans inherited the Sanskrit version of the suttas, the sutras, they call them sutras in that country, all the translations of these words are in Sanskrit instead of in Pali. Yeah, it's just a language thing. Yeah, good question. Say it again.
Geshes?
Oh, geshes. No, good question. What's a geshe? A geshe is like a professor in the monastery. It's like an abbot role. Mm-hmm. Something like that. It's a degree.
Question on Tibetan Buddhism in general. The non-dualism part really appeals to me.
Yes, but there's definitely strong different emphases in different traditions, in different lineages. So some lineages really put a strong emphasis on the non-dual, and others put more of an emphasis on approaching that gradually over a long period of time. And then a couple of the lineages focus more on introducing the non-dual immediately when a student expresses interest in the Dharma, that the non-dual is the doorway. And then for other lineages, the non-dual comes at the end of years of study, and there's a lot of things that lead up to that. But it's permeating those teachings in all those lineages to some degree, yeah.
It's maybe not related in the context of, but I don't know this word, tabernacle or
tabernacle? Tabernacle is like the inner part of a temple. A tabernacle is like a shrine. It's a shrine. Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the five colors, is there any significance with that? Specific five colors.
There is. Yeah, it's the five colors of the rainbow. So it's the five colors of the rainbow. And
Togal.
Yeah. Yeah. What does Togal mean? Togal actually means to leap. Leap. So leaping into the clear light is actually a translation of practice of Togal into the clear light. Togal means to leap over. Literally, it means to leap over. And sometimes it's translated as leap over. But it's referring to a particular advanced meditation practice that is a panoramic open awareness practice using the sky as the place of rest. A very particular practice that he's practicing here. So he's describing his practice of sky gazing. He's up there gazing into the sky, which is his practice. And then this is what he sees in the sky. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's eight extremes of conceptual elaboration. I don't know what those eight extremes are. Maybe you can.
Where are we?
Second page, seventh line. From the bottom, seventh line from the bottom, second page. Eight extremes of conceptual elaboration.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's referring to a doctrine in the Madhyamaka, which is a philosophical school that he would have been exposed to or studied, because it's part of monastic study. And part of the teaching is about all the ways that we reify, like things exist, things don't exist, things either both exist and don't exist, or things neither exist nor don't exist. It's about how we reify. And he's saying that I rest in a state free of reification. That's just his way of saying that. Yeah, yeah.
Is there a specific reason that crows get hopping as an adjective and all the other animals get more playful and joyful?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it has to do with the adjectives he chose, right? He chose. And so we don't know. We can't ask him. Yeah, we can't ask him. But he must have experienced them as something poignant, right? Poignant.
I'm interested in that also because different cultures respond very distinctly to crows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of a pan-cultural bird, but they're often either haunting or demonistic. Or as they were in early America, you had crows singing over a pregnant woman, the baby was born with then other, for Native Americans, crows were wonderful omens. They were worshipped as smart and intelligent birds, which they are.
different
so
culture?
Is there a particular cultural approach?
I don't think so. No, no. Not that I know of in Tibetan culture. I don't think so. But he clearly had a feeling. They gave him a feeling, and he was trying to capture the feeling that he had hearing the crows. Yeah, something poignant. Yeah. Hmm? Yeah. There's a lot of gender bending in Tibetan practice. Yes. Yes. So what do we think he means by that? What do you think he means by that? Maybe the darker side, playfulness there, yes. And any other thoughts?
Well, in the beginning, he mentions, you know, the father lowers lotus born, and then the second line says green dakini, right? So then in the end, he ends with the demon itself.
He says queen dakini, lady of the citadel, and I don't get the impression that he's too complimentary towards citadels. He's talking about the nations shining away.
Oh.
And so she's maybe she's one of these people of appearances.
What is a citadel?
Palace. Yeah, palace. And sometimes it's used to describe where a Buddha lives, in the non-conceptual palace, so to speak. So it may not be a negative valence. It could be a positive valence. But I think we need to be open to every read. Every read is interesting. Yes?
I was, that there's a common theme in the Tibetan canon where sort of an uptight, sort of scholarly male monk will sort of, who's sort of very fixated on kind of the structure and the teachings, but doesn't really actually get kind of totally missing the point, has their eyes opened, usually by a woman who's described as sort of in kind of witchy terms, or you know, someone who's sort of outside the structure, and they sort of come along and pull the rug out from under them and kind of help them wake up. So I was thinking, you know, he's sort of playful through the whole thing, and he's sort of poking, kind of teasing a lot of how things are, and then providing the contrast. So I see him sort of seeing himself as this sort of trickster, and maybe aligning himself with these enlightened women who've been sort of waking up people not unlike him for generations.
So one of the meanings of this word dakini is the female trickster archetype. So that's what Eric is referring to. And many of the yogis in the life stories that he has read in his training wake up through the stimulation of the dakini. The dakini is always there, waking yogis up. And yoginis, waking yogis and yoginis up. So there's this female archetype that is both playful and also challenging. Often they're challenging, and they come along, you could say, in the path of a practitioner to get them over the hump of their ego clinging and propel them into a selfless insight. So very interesting to think about that in our own lives, like who have been the Dakinis in our own lives, who have kind of been there to stimulate us or to push us a little bit into awakening. Yes.
Dakini also another meaning for Dakini. Portrayed is also a consort.
Yes. Yes, can be a consort. Yeah, can be a partner. Yeah. And in the case of up here, the father lotus-born is Padmasambhava, and the queen Dakini is referring to his partner Yashet Sojal. And she was a very powerful woman in Tibetan history, is a very powerful woman in Tibetan history. She had her own, you know, biography and her own texts and her own teachings, which is very rare. If you look in at Buddhist tradition, to have a woman right at the beginning of Buddhism in Tibet who is teaching, she was a teacher, she had her own disciples, many of whom were women. And after her, she spent some time with Padmasambhava, but she also spent quite a bit of time after her partnership with him teaching on her own and traveling. And she was a progenitor of the Dharma in Tibet. So he's really referring to this is not just an archetype that he's referring to here. He's referring to an actual historical woman who did incredible work. And that he even honors her at the beginning is a sign of his deep respect for the sacred feminine, and then he ends with the demoness himself, aligning himself with the female, is really interesting. I find it really interesting. My friend who did the editing helped edit this. It's going into some anthology later this year. She was really struck by it. She was like, did he really say that? And I went back and, you know, read the Tibetan 5 times after she said that. She's a really good translator. And I was like, yes, she did. I sent her the Tibetan, and she was like, oh, my gosh. So it was kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah, just, again, regarding that last line, this summer, my wife, my daughter, and I went to Japan and Vietnam, particularly to see the Buddhist temples there. And we had some wonderful tour guides, and many of the temples had wrathful deities, like as you would enter, and they did appear very, very demon-like, and what was explained to us was they were seen as protectors. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the negative mm-hmm. connotation that we have in the West for the word demon would not necessarily be so.
So true. So true. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. That's true. Yeah, language can be so tricky, right? The word demon and demoness is like the best that I could do or one could do. It's what most people would do with that word dremo. But it's not, it doesn't hold the same negative valence. Yeah, that's true. And also this whole idea of wrathful compassion is a big part of the Tibetan tradition. Fierce compassion that is snarling and growling and protective and loving all at the same time, right? So yeah, there's a kind of a embracing of that mood. And he talks about that, right? He says the 1,000 moods, you know, what does he say, the 100 moods? Many moods, one essence. Oh, here we go. The mind has one basis, one essence, but 100 moods, right? Mm-hmm. So he's embracing the moodiness of the mind here, and the demoness very much is an expression of that kind of understanding. But I want to add one more thing. I just think it's interesting that dremo is also, it's the word for demoness, like in the sense of that sort of divine scowling archetype, the divine scowling archetype, and also the challenging protective archetype. But it also means yeti. So, you know, the yeti that are a presence in the Himalayan region, just like Sasquatch was a presence on our continent. They have a presence like that. A man-woman ape. Often it is a woman ape, actually. They use Dremel to talk about Yeti, which is the female. It's gendered female generally, unlike Sasquatch, which is generally gendered male on this continent. Dremel, it means Yeti. And so that what I find interesting about that is that Yeti are part human and part animal. That's sort of their MO. They're part human and they're part animal. For me, that really stands out in this poem because he's so close to the natural world and he has left society in order to be in this wild space like an animal, like to live like an animal almost, you know, in harmony with the animals. And there's so many animals in this poem, right? So it's like he's saying, I'm half human, half beast. And not in a bad way, but like he's happy to say it. He's like, you know, he's declaring his connection or something. That's how this offering that as a possible read. Yeah, there's two of you, so yeah, start with.
About mm-hmm. the word leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Is that significant?
What do you think?
Yeah,
yeah. And what do you think it means to leap into the clear light?
It's kind of, it's not a gradual thing. Mm. It's like it kind of hits
yeah.
in the face.
Yeah.
Does that
make sense? Yes, yes. And I do think that is a bit, there's some of that in the essence of this practice, Togal, is a profound release and letting go, kind of like, leaping into the sky, right? Leaping into the clear light, leaping into the open, non-conceptual awareness, leaping into it, as opposed to gradually, yeah.
Almost aha.
Aha. Yeah. Yeah. Something sudden about that. Yeah. Something. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's you're capturing some of the essence of that word. Yes. No, I don't think so. I think it's too limiting. Yeah, it's too limiting because it has some. I mean, I suppose you could, but
because in English, mm-hmm. really does have
you find feel a negative.
Specific,
interesting.
It's very limited in its connotation.
Interesting.
In
yeah.
Well, for me, demon is also
maybe
being, shadow.
At what?
Shadow side.
Yes. I do think there is a shadow side implication to Dremel in Tibetan, for sure. Like Dremel, you find them in the cemeteries, right? You find them hanging out in the places that scare you, mm-hmm. which is a good thing, like it's leaning towards the places that scare you. Yeah. Hmm. Yes. Well, that is actually a very specific year. Mm-hmm. And I could look the year up. I do know what it is. It's like 1436 or something. I'm sorry, 1736 or something. Not 1436. 1736 or something like that. It's a very specific year. So the cycles are on 12-year cycles. So it's not that he chose the word male there. He chose it to identify the year. There are female years too. It just happened to be, that's the name of that particular, it's almost like he's saying, in the seventh month of 1736, he's trying to identify what time it was when he had this vision.
Okay,
yeah. Exactly, yeah. So it's not that kind of, it's not, in this case, a literary choice, yeah.
I don't know why I'm so going back and forth between so too I and so I too?
That's my problem. It's a problem. It won't be that way in the final version. I just did that. No, it's very, yes. And with all of you reading out loud, it became very clear to me that I have to go through and be more consistent. Either it's I too or so too I to decide. No, it's exactly the same structure, exactly the same structure in the Tibetan. I just chose to put it in a different order in some of the verses. Yeah.
I actually like that.
You like that it's a different order? Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
There was something about it.
Okay.
That it's different.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
You've really picked a lovely reading where the author does seem quite balanced or enlightened around sort of gender. But a lot of the Tibetan teachings aren't. Like some of them are, well, just outright misogynistic.
In all of Buddhism, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so just to put it out there, it's like way slanted on one side, and I love hearing that people are interested in the divine feminine, but it seems way out of balance.
Yes.
In the standard teaching. So I'm just curious how you, as a translator and practitioner, relate to that.
Yeah. Well, I have, for my whole life, been very concerned about it and concerned about how we rebalance the Dharma, not just Tibetan Dharma, but all Dharma, all Buddhism, all Buddha Dharma, to reflect the inner essence of the teachings, which is really not misogynistic. And I think those misogynistic, those patriarchal valences and that cultural context is very entwined with some of the Buddhist presentations and practices and suttas. And so my interest as a practitioner has been to think about how do we practice the Dharma here in the West, and how are we going to not carry the baggage of the past with us, and how do we reimagine a Dharma here that is accessible, that empowers people of all genders, and how do we think about the Dharma given that our understanding of gender is no longer binary? Our understanding of gender, or my understanding of gender, is that it is a fluid continuum. And so how do we reimagine a Dharma here? And in some ways, I feel like that's what my whole life is about, is that. And in some cases, certainly in, I mean, this could be, we could just talk, I could talk about this for an hour, but I'm just going to say a little bit, and then we'll take a break and then go out into the woods. Some of the like what we choose to practice has to be rethought, and how we choose to practice. And the practices that I did in my training, I can't teach many of those. I won't. I refuse. Like, I just won't. Some of the ways that I was trained to practice, so I'm not teaching those things anymore. It's a very exciting time, actually. I see it more not so much as there are times when I've thought about, should I just not be a Buddhist, given the history? Should I just not be a Buddhist? I've thought about that, full disclosure. But I love the truths of the tradition. I love the teachings. I find the teaching on the Four Noble Truths to be more profound and liberatory than anything I've encountered. Like a progenitor, that's like the very basic teaching of Buddhism, and it speaks to me so deeply. And the practices of the Tibetan tradition have changed my life. And so I can't ignore that either. And my solution is don't do the things that try not to engage with the parts of the tradition that reinforce the patriarchy. Try to live on the fringes of the tradition, not in the center of the institutions, where it's pretty hard to avoid some of those influences. And I've been very encouraged by the fact that I can teach. I'm gendered, I don't know, I'm more or less gendered female. Or I choose that, I choose she, her pronouns, and I'm able to teach here. Would I be able to teach this way in Tibet? No. But we have that freedom in the West, and we have those expectations are different here, and we've been able to make a lot of progress here, which we may not have been able to make. And things are changing there, radically changing. Women are now becoming geshes, like that professor. Women are becoming, geshema is a thing now. Geshema, female geshes, kenmos are now everywhere. Kenmos are another degree. Women who are now fully authorized professors in the monasteries and the nunneries. So those things are very new, but it's only within the last 50 years. But it's happening, and partly it's happening because those things started happening here, and Westerners going back to Asia and saying, what's up with this? And then, you know, even recently, I went to Bhutan and was visiting a monastery there and talked to somebody in one of the, he said, here are our geshe, training for the geshes, and here's, I said, well, where's the training for the geshemas? And he was flustered, and he was like, we're working on that. We are.
Yes. Well, so what happened is last year when I was in Dharamsala, you know, I told you about that nunnery, what's her name, I forget, but your friend who runs the, you know, the female all-women nunnery. They, for the first time in history, they had in Bhutan, all these nuns were traveling, and they were being ordained as actual monks, you know, mm-hmm. So for the first time. So they were all excited.
Oh, fully ordained, yeah, full ordination.
When he said he was working on it, it was really happening while I was there.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah. These milestones are historical for these cultures to begin to move into, and there was resistance in the early days. Even 20, 30 years ago, there was resistance, and now the sea change is happening. So, yeah, change is slow, but important, critical.
I feel like it's essential for Buddhism to survive. You know? Mm-hmm. It's not a question of, it's a question of survival in a way.
Yes.
Because as we evolve, it has to happen.
It has to happen, yes. Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of Christina Feldman, who was the founder of the Gaia House in London, in Erin. Mm-hmm. And she was in a monastery for 3 years. I'm not remembering which culture, which tradition. But left when she was told in no uncertain terms by one of her teachers that she would never attain enlightenment because she was a woman.
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. I don't blame her. That's too bad.
She wrote Woman.
Which one?
Woman Awake.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Take a look at that. Yeah.
Christina Feldman. Okay. She's the founder of the Gaia House. Mm.
So, let's take a little break and let's reconvene at in 15 minutes, which is about 10:30. We'll reconvene in front of the hall there. Okay. And bring your backpacks. I'm going to bring some garbage bags because I do want to sit. I want us to sit today, and it's a little wet. So I'm going to bring garbage bags for us to sit on. But if you have a tarp or, you know, poncho, please do bring it, a raincoat, because we don't know what we're going to encounter. And we may be okay, or we may have to come back. We'll see. But it's looking pretty good right now. And so remember your tarp, raincoat, water. I feel like I'm forgetting something. I don't think we're going to need our notebook, but you can bring it if you want. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll see you in a few minutes.